Welcome. I think we will get started for the sake of time. My name is Wendy and I serve the village as an education associate as of a few weeks ago. And we're really excited to have John Doltner here sharing his project called A Piece of My Mind, which it sounds like has been culminating over many years of storytelling and his gift of photography. And I just want you all to know that this is a recorded session, so it'll be something that you can come back to if you want to listen to in the future, but also just know that comments and questions are recorded as well. So thank you all for being here at 4:15. We'll be done at 5:15 with plenty of time to get to dinner. So thank you, John, for being here.
Yes, thank you.
Wendy, do you mind turning off those other lights?
I would love to.
Is that all right? And let's set a little tone. It's been a big day. We've been here for 2 days of physical labor now, so maybe you're a little tired like me. Well, I haven't actually done 2 full days of physical labor. There were some big goodbyes, so maybe you're a little emotional. So let's just take a minute to assess where we're at in just a moment of quiet. And let me just try to set the tone with something I wrote Sunday night. I came here a little weary, actually, from a really busy work schedule. Maybe from the political stuff that's going on, just feeling a little weary. So I'd like to share with you something I wrote the first night we got in, and maybe it will resonate with you, and it's called A Slow Boat to Paradise. I was nervous for what we would see. Under a warm blue sky, we motored north through the cold, deep waters of Lake Chelan, past rocky ridges, charred pine, and ashen mountainsides. 1 year ago, to the day, we were evacuated from Holden Village as the Wolverine Fire raced through the dry wilderness. We drove out through thick smoke and arrived at the Lucerne Dock to wait for the ferry that would both deliver the Forest Service crews to battle the fire and deliver us from harm's way. I'd heard about Holden more than a decade before. I'd seen the pictures, I'd dreamt of it, I'd traced the contour lines of this valley on a topographical map long before the day I could make the trip. Sometimes when you build something up so large in your mind, real life has a hard time competing. But this wasn't the case for Holden. See, I had anticipated the scenery, the stunning and remote setting at the base of these dramatic twin peaks. I understood the adventure of the journey with the 2-hour boat ride up this lake, followed by a 10-mile drive up gravel switchbacks in a repurposed school bus named Linnea. I was all in before we even started driving west. What I failed to understand was the sense of community. Holden wasn't just a place, it was a group of people living together intentionally in the wilderness in close quarters with limited resources. Holden was a place that both sought and embodied spirit. So on the day we evacuated, I had the feeling like I'd briefly tasted paradise a year ago, but with the heavy realization that paradise could soon be consumed by fire. And we worried, we prayed, we scoured social media and the internet for any shred of news that we could find, and we waited, because some things are just out of your hands. In the end, the Wolverine Fire was a bad fire in a bad season of fires, but Holden was spared, and this week we got to return. I was worried for what we would see. The fire had devastated the wilderness and the forest was reduced in many places to charred stumps and barren ridges. But even just 12 months later, the fire weed had blossomed. Carpets of purple softened the landscape of ashen gray, and while some of the areas appeared to be totally devastated, others were more of the patchwork, with green and brown alternating in the mosaic across the valley. I went in feeling like I would witness total destruction, but I found sustained life as well as new life. In fact, Holden was still Holden. Some things, many things had changed, but it was a part of a bigger cycle, and life carried on. And then I wondered if the same could be true for our world. for our nation. At the moment, I feel like we're living on the edge of tragedy, and maybe it's the political season, but maybe something more has shifted. Maybe we're no longer interested in finding common ground. Maybe we're more interested in being right. Maybe we want to feel safe and guarded and insulated. Maybe a defensive posture is the new norm as we face the world around us. In many ways, it feels like our society is as fragile as I've ever known, and I worry that if someone were to toss a lit match into the dry landscape of our social fabric, it would quickly go up in flames. Maybe. But we're stronger than that, and our strength comes from a higher power. Holden Village survived because people took care of it. They planned. They replaced wooden roofs with metal ones. They installed the Rainbird sprinkler system. They wrapped porches in foil. They saw weaknesses and they fortified against them. And when the inferno came raging up the valley toward them, they lit backfires to eliminate the fuel that could feed the oncoming fire. Can we do the same? Can we fortify our social compact against tragedy? Can we work together to try to remove the fuel that could feed a fire that would consume us? Can we do that? And will we do that? So this is a long way for me to say that it's really good to be here today with you. And so for my few sessions, we're going to talk about this project called A Piece of My Mind. It's a project that uses portraits and stories to explore the meaning of peace. It's a project whose intent is to find and rediscover that common humanity that connects us, and maybe even the flame of divinity that burns in each one of us. I'm a little intimidated following academics and theologians as your educators, because I'm neither one. I'm definitely not a theologian. Sometimes I'm probably not even a very good Lutheran. I can't quote much scripture. But I constantly come back to Jesus' commandment to love one another. And it doesn't, I've looked through the Bible for the exceptions and the loopholes, and I don't think it exists. It doesn't say love the ones that look like you, or love the ones that live like you, or even love the ones that are going to vote like you in the next election cycle. It says love one another, period. And that's where this project begins. So a little while ago, I had this project in Memphis at the Gandhi King Conference for Nonviolence. And I was reminded of Dr. Martin Luther King's idea of a beloved community, right? The idea that we could grow into a world beyond prejudice and discrimination, that we could expand our circle of compassion to wrap around people outside of our immediate families. And I think you don't have to look very far to recognize that we've fallen short of that mark, right? That there are all sorts of ways that we fail to meet that ideal. But sometimes I think when it feels like the world is maybe the most challenged it's ever been, I think we need to remember that we might be looking in the wrong place. You know, we're just not recognizing the good that still exists. I've worked as a freelance photographer for 20 years. I shoot for national magazines and Fortune 500 companies. Very often, I shoot travel photography around the Midwest, around the country, and around the world. And people hire me to find beauty in unexpected places. Right? It's my job to find the good where you might not expect it. And that doesn't mean that we ignore the challenges that we face, but it does mean that we approach the challenges with the grace and humility and hope and belief that something better is possible. When you're a freelance photographer, you're constantly making choices about the projects you're going to accept. Does this square up with my worldview? Is it going to promote ideas that I feel good about? Does it pay enough to justify being away from my family for a little while? And at our house, we have a saying that some jobs feed the belly, and you probably know how this ends. Some jobs feed the soul. And when you're really lucky, your job can do both. So back around 2009, I found that my soul was extremely hungry. You know, I was concerned increasingly with the quality of our national dialogue, the way all of these things asked us to look at what could separate us, whether it's politics, ethnicity, religion, gender, class, you name it. If you choose to go through life dividing, you've got all sorts of tools available to you. But I wondered if I could use my photography and my storytelling instead to look for that common humanity that connects us. As luck would have it, I like to say the economy handed me some pizza. Maybe you know some other people that happened too. The recession hit and the world of freelance photography changed quickly and dramatically. And if I was a better business person, I would have used that time to look for new clients. But not every decision is based in dollars and cents. And like I said, my soul was getting hungry. So this is how I decided to feed it. And I started playing around with this idea of peace. And I found, as I've traveled, that there are very few people who wouldn't welcome more peace into their lives. You know, whether it's in their immediate family or their community or the larger world, even my friends who serve in the U.S. military would prefer to stay home with their families whenever possible. But here's the thing about peace. We say that we want it, but we're not very good at getting it. So you'll have high school students who might flash the sign as they walk down the hall or frame up their selfies, but then they'll form into cliques and they'll bully their own classmates. You'll have peace activists who might stand out on the road with a sign that says, give peace a chance, but they can't get along with their immediate family members. You'll have two countries that claim they want to find a peaceful resolution to a conflict, but they won't agree on the shape of the negotiating table to sit at. And at our own church, called ironically Peace Lutheran Church, you'll have people that nod up and down on Sunday morning as they listen to the story of the Good Samaritan, and then Monday walk by someone in need like it's not their problem. You know, and that's not an indictment of our church, that's an indictment of the human condition. Because this happens all the time. There's a disconnect between what we say we value and how we live our day-to-day lives. And that's what I wanted to explore with this project. So I started playing around with this simple question, what does peace mean to you? And on the surface, that's a really simple question, but it quickly gets at the core of who we are as human beings and what we value as a society. It opens the door to all sorts of conversations about civic responsibility, conflict resolution, about national priorities and international policy. And I started talking to people from all different backgrounds, asking them this question, recording their stories and taking a portrait. And I should tell you that there's no reason this should have been me doing this project. I'm not an expert in matters of peace. I've got no advanced degree, no secret answers. Every once in a while, Karen has the right to think maybe I should go back and reread the book that I had just written about peace. You know, I think we all struggle in various ways, and we all miss the mark, but just because we struggle doesn't mean we should stop trying. And so A Piece of My Mind became a project about listening, about hearing people's stories. And as I started listening to these stories, I began to hear some wisdom that sometimes gets drowned out in the noise of day-to-day life. And I heard from people like Imani Jafar Mohammed, who is a lawyer and a partner in a law firm. And in her free time, she goes out and she speaks to churches and schools and other community groups about what it means to be a Muslim woman in America today. And Imani says that sometimes she'll go into these two-hour presentations and she'll have this talk, and at the end of it, some guy will stand up in the back and say, well, I think you're so oppressed. To which Imani replies, you don't even know me. You know, it's as if everything she said is untrue just because that person chooses not to believe it. I met people like David DeLambert Jr., who's lived on the streets of Minneapolis for 30 years. He invites people to sign his coats with a marker that he carries around and maybe give him a dollar or two in return. And this engagement started out being David's way to get by, you know, day to day. Eventually he recognized that this was his way to connect with other people. And David has filled up more than 100 coats over the years, and in his own words, when he fills them up, he gives them away to someone who's less fortunate than he is. I talked to Fred and Judy Barron, who are Holocaust survivors. They were in Bergen-Belsen together. They didn't meet until they were in the hospital in Sweden, recovering after the liberation. And they got married, they moved to America, and started a family, trying to rediscover peace after having lived in a place that had none. And Fred says that he's amazed with the technology we have available to us, right? That we can send a person to the moon and bring them back again, that we can transplant the organs from one person into another to give them new life, and that we carry around in our pockets computers that are more powerful than what filled up a room 20 or 30 years ago. But Fred says, in the way we relate to one another as human beings, person to person, human to human, we continue to struggle in so many ways, and that's what we have to focus on. And I met Ode Muhawish, who was raised in Jordan and now lives in Minnesota, so he likes to say he was born a Middle Easterner and he's now a Midwesterner. And Ode says, imagine if Moses and Jesus and Muhammad were to come back and stand in front of us today. And Moses would say to his people, what have you done? And Jesus would say to his people, what have you done? And Muhammad would say to his people, what have you done? And they would all be disappointed with us. For me, stories have the ability to reveal universal truths in a way that just facts and statistics cannot. Stories have a way of helping us understand one another and helping us understand ourselves at the same time. So when I listen to Imani talk, I have to ask myself if I'm actually hearing what she's trying to say. When I think about David DeLambert's story, I have to ask myself if he's able to reach out to help other people, why do I struggle to do the same myself? Fred and Judy Barron make me question whether I'm paying attention to the things that are important. And Ode invites me to consider whether I am living up to the ideals that I claim to hold. And sometimes when we ask these questions, we're faced with some pretty uncomfortable truths. You know, and I think that it's good for us to be uncomfortable in the process. You know, sometimes we shy away from that, but in that discomfort, we can stretch and we can grow. And we come face to face with our own bias, right? And we all have biases. I'll tell you that very early in this project, I had a chance to interview a man who was an oil company executive. We were slowly going broke. We decided to sell our lovely great big pickup truck and buy a 10-year-old Honda Civic so that we could afford gas. Gas prices were going through the roof. And I promise you, when I had the chance to sit down and talk with an oil company executive, I had a preconceived notion of what that person was going to be like, and it wasn't positive, right? But once I sat down with him, once I had that conversation and I was able to listen to his story, I recognized the humanity in Mark Williams that I was unable to accept or recognize going into it. So the first 50 stories for this project were produced in Minnesota. It's got a very broad, diverse worldview because of who the people are, but they were produced in Minnesota. I got funding to produce a traveling exhibit. So we bring this exhibit into schools and community groups and use it to foster dialogue about social change, about civic responsibility. And then a year or so later, we ran a Kickstarter campaign to publish a book. We had talked with publishers for about a year and they all said, well, this is a great concept, beautiful photos, engaging text, but we don't think we're gonna make any money off of it, so good luck. So we ran a Kickstarter campaign, which is where you bother all your friends and family to give you money and hope that they continue to be your friends and family. And we got Gandhi's granddaughter, Eva Gandhi, to write the foreword for the book. And at that point, I kind of thought I was done with the project. You know, we had a website and the stories were online as podcasts, we had the exhibit, we had the book. But then I realized pretty quickly that there was more work to do. So over the last 3 years, I've been traveling across the country to work on A Piece of My Mind, American Stories. So I've driven 40,000 miles, visited 46 states, and done 100 new interviews. And those interviews, that book should come out September of this year, September 21st, the International Day of Peace. So last year, this was the trip that led us to Holden. It was part of a 7,000 or 8,000 mile loop, 5 weeks through the western states. So as I've worked on this project, very often, you know, I've interviewed over 150 people now, and very often people ask what I've learned along the way, and at first that was a really hard question to answer, because all of these people have shared their stories in such unique and interesting ways. They've shared little bits of wisdom. But there are a few themes that have bubbled up over the years, and I'd like to share a few of those with you today. And the first is from a man named Mel Duncan, who runs a group called Nonviolent Peace Force. Has anybody heard of that? Okay. When people suggest to me that peace is a position of weakness, or that it's a wimpy and passive approach to the world, I like to tell them about Nonviolent Peace Force, because they will take well-trained and unarmed individuals and insert them into violent conflict around the world. You know, you can go to the most war-torn nations on earth and you'll find brave local men and women on the ground who are working towards nonviolent solutions. The problem is they don't tend to live very long. Right? Both sides of the conflict want them out of the way, and they're not afraid to make that happen. Nonviolent Peace Force has figured out that if you put international observers on the ground working side by side with those local peacemakers, they tend to live longer and they can do their work. And Mel says that we struggle with a shrunken notion of our own abilities. We struggle with a shrunken notion of our own ability. We have the ability to bring substantial change, but often we don't own that. We're afraid of that. In fact, we can make change, and it often comes from a small group of dedicated and persistent people. And so my question for you today would be, can we be those people? We can do big things. Lesson number two, the time is now. Jennifer McNally had gone to Florida to visit a friend who was dying of lung cancer in the hospital. And she said she walked into the room, and in the room there was a whiteboard, and on the whiteboard it listed the patient name, vital statistics, and then it said patient goals, but it was blank. And her friend said, there are no goals listed. Grab a pen, I need your help to write down goals. And so together they wrote down, get well, go home, and spread joy. And Jennifer said, even as my friend was struggling so much, she was still thinking about other people. And she said, that's what peace is to me. It's being able to find that sort of beauty even when there's pain. It's knowing that even when life is bad, it's still really, really good. And when I listen to that story, I have to ask myself how often I've waited to act, right? I would give more money to this charity if I had a little extra cash. If I wasn't so busy, I would volunteer more often, and I'd get along better with my neighbor if he wasn't such a jerk, right? There's always a reason not to act. But if we wait for conditions to be perfect before we do the things we say we want to do, we're never going to act. So the time is now. The world is overflowing with need. Why not choose now to make a difference? And lesson number three, think of others. And this is Eric Gibson, who's a Buddhist teacher and a financial planner, which I think is a really interesting combination. But this is what I love about interfaith dialogue. You know, we had this great hour-long conversation, and never once did Eric try to convert me to Buddhism, and never once did I try to make Eric become a Lutheran. But every once in a while, Eric would share a story that I could recognize from my own tradition, and I would say, oh yeah, we talked about that too, in this slightly different way. And there's a foothold of a relationship. There's the beginning of common ground, and that can expand and that can grow from there. So Eric shared this Buddhist saying, which is, when you think about your own happiness, then you'll always have problems. But when you think about the happiness of others, then there's always interesting work to do. And I think the same could be said about Holden. When you're thinking about others, there's interesting work to do. The same could be said about our Christian notion of service, that if you can take that focus off of yourself and your own immediate needs and your own need for success and happiness and entertainment and all those things and turn it around to focus on the needs of others, somehow miraculously, that circles back to yourself. So I've told you a fair amount about what peace means to others. It's probably only fair that I also share with you what peace means to me. And I think maybe you've got a sense that I'm a little bit of an idealist, but I'm also a realist. You know, my glasses have a warm tint, but they're not rose-colored. And I don't think we're ever going to live in a world without conflict. You know, I think we're always going to butt heads in some fashion. We're always going to have different interests that lead us into conflict. My question is, what happens when we encounter that conflict? How do we respond when we see it coming down the road or when we're embroiled in the conflict? Are we going to make it worse, or are we going to do something to make it better? And I don't think neutrality is really an option, because neutrality is a vote for the status quo. So if you see something that should change, then it becomes up to us to change it. And for me, this is all rooted in relationship. And I'll give you an example. When we first moved to our current house in Bloomington, I was working in the garage. I think I probably hit my thumb, because I know I said a bad word right as a new neighbor walked up the driveway. Great timing. And he said, you know, we have a first Friday of the month party in this neighborhood every month, and you should come. And I don't think I was paying attention, because he said it again. He said, I really want you to be there. And he said, you know why? And I said, why don't you tell me? And he said, someday your kids are probably going to do something stupid. I said, maybe. He said, I don't know what it's going to be. Maybe they'll throw a ball through my window. Maybe they'll ride their bikes through my flower beds or ring my doorbell late at night and run away. I don't know what they're going to do, but someday they're going to do something stupid. And when that happens, I don't want it to be the first time that I've met you. Right? He recognized that conflict would come our way. And if you have a relationship already established, you've got some place to begin to resolve that conflict. If you've got no relationship in place, you've got no place to begin to find a resolution. And I think, for me, whether you're talking about a neighbor down the road, or whether you're talking about a country on the other side of the world, the same model holds true. Right? That we need to work intentionally now to build relationships, so when we encounter conflict, we have some way to resolve it. There's a quote from Rabbi Amy Eilberg, who is the first female to be ordained in the conservative movement of Judaism. First female to be ordained. And wow, I can't see it all. Give me a second. I got it. She says that when she walks into situations where she expects to find conflict, like if she's bringing Jewish communities to visit with Palestinian leaders, she says the first thing she does, I'm likely to do some conscious breathing. I remind myself to slow down the pace of my communication, to slow down the pace of the time between when I'm inwardly reacting and when I'm outwardly responding. Sometimes it's whispering to myself to just listen. Sometimes it's consciously watching my breath as someone is talking, and I feel my pulse beginning to beat more rapidly. I remind myself to notice that the stillness is gone from my mind, my body, and my spirit. And sometimes such moments, when they're really hard and really challenging, are also enlivening, because there's this sort of wordless sense within that this is the moment when we get to be present for something that's potentially a moment of conflict, but could also be a moment of great transformation. You know, and so I think we need to ask ourselves, when we find ourselves in those situations, how are we going to respond? Now I'm in trouble. So the question I want you to sit with for just a moment is, what does peace mean to you? So when we have my exhibit present, at this point we would take a few minutes to sort of stroll around and look at some of the stories. I think we have time instead to do that with books. I brought enough books for everybody. And maybe someone from up top wants to come down and grab 10 of them or so.
I can bring them up.
Okay. and if somebody else wants to help me distribute them. Think about this question. We're going to spread out these books and a little worksheet. Anybody else? Oh, we planned well. Good. Or we got lucky. So I have worksheets that I would pass out, but I don't think it's necessary. I'm just going to give you some instructions. We're going to take about 10 minutes to look through the stories, and I want you to do three things. I want you to flip through and find somebody that you're interested in knowing more about. Read that story, read that biography. I actually encourage people to read the quote first and then the biography, because for me, things like David DeLamper Jr., if you read his quote before you realize he's been on the streets of Minneapolis for 30 years, it takes on an entirely different context from when you read his biography first and then the quote. So I want you to find somebody that you're interested in learning more about. I want you to find somebody that looks like they have something in common with you. You can define that however you want, but sort of acknowledge and recognize what that commonality is. And then I want you to find somebody that you think you probably have nothing in common with, or very little in common with. And again, I want you to sort of acknowledge that and recognize that in your choice. So go ahead and flip through. Somewhere between 8 and 10 minutes, we'll do that.
Where's the quote?
Okay, so the structure of the book, portrait, name, this little part down here, this is the biography. Yeah. That's a little portion that I wrote about who the person is. This larger block of text, that's a quote, an excerpt that's directly taken out of their hour-long interview that we did. And good luck taking an hour-long interview and condensing it down to 250 words. So I'm curious, who did you want to learn more about? Was there one that stood out to you and grabbed your attention? Yeah.
Jeff Kennedy.
Jeff Kennedy. And what was it that, can't say, don't know?
Never had a dinner together in 50 years.
Oh, yeah.
As a family.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, imagine that.
Never seen an American black family eat dinner at the table in 50 years. And that was all it took.
Yeah. We're going to talk more about that on Thursday when I do my next thing. We're going to have a writing exercise about identity that sort of explores what our experience has been and how that might differ from what other people's experiences have been and how that colors a worldview. Now, when you talk about personal security, when you talk about feeling welcomed and loved, and you think about what it is in your upbringing and your experience that has led to that, and then think about if that were completely absent, what that would do. Yeah, thank you. Anybody else? Yeah.
Sammy Razzulli.
What drew you to that story?
He's an Iraqi American, and he founded Muslim Peacemaker Team. I'm familiar with the Christian Peacemaker Team, and the Muslim Peacemaker Team resulted from that, but I didn't know about him. Yeah. anything about him in particular.
Yeah, yeah, he had encountered the Christian peacemaking teams, and he said, why can't we do this in Iraq, which is where he came from originally. And so I can't remember, honestly, if he's Sunni or Shia, but when they were having so much sectarian violence, whatever group he was from, Group A, if Group B had a bombing in their community, he would gather up a bunch of Group A and bring them in and say, here, we'll help you clean things up. Really brave, really courageous. And it worked, you know, and it didn't eliminate the fault lines, but it helped bridge those fault lines just a little bit. So thank you for sharing. Did someone else have their hand up over here? Yeah.
Marlene Jaruzski.
Jaruzski, yeah.
Okay. So I have a ski at the end of my name too, so I, you know, relate.
So that, yeah, that was the similarity that you were looking for. Good.
More similarity. She said that when she grew, as she was growing up, that, she had a peaceful childhood. You know, there was no nothing wrong with her childhood. And there was no violence in home. But the one thing that was that her father was racist. And in my life, it was very peaceful in my home. Grew up fine. But there was an undercurrent of some racial, you know, tendencies. And it goes on to say that there's peace issues out there, and you got to do what you can do, and she's trying to help people understand that, you know, that peace comes from within.
Yeah, there's I'm really fond of the word responsibility and how that word breaks up into response and ability, you know, and we can't all respond equally to every issue in the world. Right, there are a lot of grave issues that all require attention, but each of us has that one thing that we feel called to, you know, and that we have the ability to respond to. And I think sometimes there's the inclination to always work on improving our weaknesses, but I think there's a lot to be said for engaging our strengths as well. So recognizing where our response ability lies in the world. Yeah.
I was looking at Jeff Blodgett.
Jeff Blodgett.
Because he had worked to carry on Paul Wellstone's work.
Right, he'd been the campaign manager for Wellstone many times and then carried it on after Wellstone was gone.
Because what he spoke about here was mature leadership and urging people to action.
Yeah.
That leadership is urging people, other people, to action. What he says is power can be used for good or evil. Power is usually wielded by leaders, and power is a neutral concept, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, and it's up to the person who wields it to depend or to determine what its influence is going to be. Yeah, and I think you'll notice in these stories that there are very few people with name recognition. Right? There aren't a lot of famous people in the book. Al Cui, who used to be governor of Minnesota, maybe the closest thing to a famous person.
Chuck Hoffman. Yeah.
And Chuck Hoffman. I was wondering who would find Chuck Hoffman first. Yeah. And interestingly enough, Peg is going to be in my second book. I interviewed her last year when I was here. So there's a little holding continuity between the two books, which I kind of like.
Jack Nelson Palmer was a summer teaching staff coordinator here.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, in the 80s.
Okay.
In East West Sarah.
Yeah, so moderate fame.
Well, moderate Holden connection.
Yeah, right. One more.
I'm wondering where Julius C. Collins III is from. I liked that he was so hopeful about being African American, and can you recall where he's from?
Yeah, he's from Minneapolis, and he, so this is the interesting way in which this project evolved. I connected with Julius because I was going to photograph a band that a friend of mine led. He needed some promotional material, so I said, okay, I'll photograph this show, and Julius Collins was the lead singer for it. So I photographed him, kind of a striking guy, and shot a lot of photos, and when I got home and I edited the photos, he wore sunglasses while he was performing, and I looked, I zoomed in, there's a little something on the side of his sunglasses, and it happened to be a peace sign. And I said, I wonder if there's something going on there. So I talked to my friend and I said, can you connect me with Julius? And I called him and I said, so I'm working on this project. It was pretty early in the project. And I said, asking people, you know, what does peace mean to you? Are you interested in sitting down? And he goes, he said, hang on. He said, peace is my ambassador. I said, okay, that's good enough. Let's set up a time and sit down and talk. So he continues to be a musician. You know, for those of you who haven't read the story, he's married to a Caucasian woman who was a lawyer and but was not happy, so she decided to be a gardener, and they paid an economic cost for that, but they're both happy. However, he also, her parents have never met their children or their grandkids because they couldn't get over the fact that there was a mixed race marriage that their daughter was in.
Yeah, and I grew up like that with my mom and dad thinking that. And we lived in Atlanta, Georgia in the 60s, and we weren't allowed to play with, you know, the African-American children. But, and then we ended up adopting these kids. And my mom and dad actually tried to talk us out of it. And now, of course, they're, but, you know, it's just interesting that that he is so positive. And, I mean, he celebrates the, how far we've come as a country, you know, as the United States. All these people from different parts of the United States have different stories. And for him, and I mean, I know Minneapolis is such a, when I think of going there, I think, oh, it's such a happy place.
Except in January, right?
Well, I just thought they were all so friendly there. And then to be in Chicago and living there with African American people and feeling the struggles there, so I was just curious as to where he came from, because he is so positive about the relationships that he's able to have with, you know, he just takes that as a wonderful thing that he can marry a Caucasian woman.
Yeah, and his goal in his music is to sort of bring joy to others and create a space where that can happen. We've got a little bit of time. I just want to, for those of you that didn't read Julius's story, I just love this quote. I think there's nothing wrong with being Afrocentric. Or, you know, having an affinity for Italians, if you're Italian, or to be proud of being Irish, if you're Irish. I think that's what makes us beautiful. This is actually what makes us strong and smart, and it's what's going to make us last. But when you plant a whole row of elm trees, they get Dutch elm disease. You have to mix in. You have to cross-pollinate, and that's the essence of survival for me. And my lack of peace comes when people don't acknowledge that my happiness and my survival is directly related to yours. And I think that's beautiful. Julius grew up in the foster care system, says this in his bio, and he learned to keep his guard up early as a defense mechanism, and it was finally years later that he realized he was happier when he let that guard down. And I think that's probably a lesson that takes a lot of us a long time to learn. It's interesting to me when I ask folks from my generation and around to pick out people that they have similarities, you know, recognize familiarity with, and very often I think they're going to come back, you know, with someone whose gender and ethnicity matches their own. I did this a little while ago with fifth graders, and with my experience, I expected the same thing. They would all come back with someone that sort of matched them demographically, and this little fifth grade Somali boy ran back, and he said, ooh, I want to share my story. And I said, well, who did you pick? And he said, Kelly Canole, who is a middle-aged white college professor that teaches pottery. And I said, really? I said, what is it that you and Kelly have in common? He said, well, she likes pottery, and I like pottery. And it gave me so much hope that my imposition, my expectations of him were that he was going to pick based on gender and ethnicity. He saw beyond that. So my question is, what happens between that age and this age that changes that? I don't know if that's a rhetorical question or a real question. What happens? Where does that innocence go? Where does that ability to see beyond those fault lines, where does that go?
You listen to other people.
You listen to other people.
Jaden and sarcastic.
Jaden and sarcastic. Yeah.
When you worry there's not enough.
What?
When you worry there's not enough.
Come at life from a place of scarcity. Yeah. I need mine. Any other thoughts?
Careful.
We learn to be careful. Protect ourselves.
Think of that song from South Pacific. We have to be carefully taught.
So this question of race, I mean, this book, you know, is pretty diverse. The next one will be, I think, even more diverse. I continue to learn. You know, I heard people say, well, there aren't many Native American voices in here. So we were intentional about finding more Native American voices. There aren't a lot of young people, so we're intentional about including young people and people with disabilities. And I'll talk more about that on Thursday. Friday, we're going to talk really specifically about some racial issues. Karen and I were at the Sojourner Summit for Change in D.C. Mm-hmm. Last year, we went there with my exhibit for A Piece of My Mind. This year, we went and created sort of on-the-spot collection of the people who were attending the conference. And Jim Wallace's new book is all about race in America, America's original sin. And so we crafted a question built around race and had people respond to that, and we'll talk more about that on Friday. So I hope you can come back for those. We'll have a couple minutes for questions, but before we do, I want to talk about one other thing. I don't know if you've noticed that around the Holden village, there are little peace signs that are cropping up.
Pine needles.
Yeah, you saw the pine needles out here. There are pine cones, there are stones, there are little drawings in the ground. There's none in the snow right now. This was from Colorado earlier in the year. This has become a little bit of a meditation for me, and I want to ask for it to become a meditation for you as well. There are a lot of similarities between these little peace signs out here and the process of peace making in the real world, in that it takes no special tools, it takes no special skill, and it doesn't take much time to create a little bit of peace. You all familiar with the Nookshooks that mark the trails in, I think it's Inuit tradition, little stone piles that look like little people that basically say, I've been here, you're not alone. And to me, these peace signs can be an indication that we are committed, that we will do our part to make a difference in the world. And these are little reminders as you go by and you see your own peace sign that you made, or you see one that somebody else made of, oh yeah, I'm not doing this by myself. There are others out there. So I would ask you, as you go through your days here at Holden, to think about adding one somewhere. Also, like real life, they're not permanent, right? These are fragile things. And the wind might blow the pine needles away. Someone might, who's not thinking about it, might walk by and kick it and destroy it. And when that happens, we can either leave it destroyed or we can take a little bit of time and repair it and make it present again. So I would ask you to lend itself. Chuck, I thought of you and Peg who write prayers on your canvases and then cover them with paint, and those prayers are eternal in the painting. And I wondered if maybe on some of these things that are going to get covered with grass or get covered with gravel, if we drew a little peace sign on there, then we would embed it. There's a tradition called the suppression chamber in the Buddhist tradition, and they will take, I don't remember the name of this female figure in Buddhism, but when they're building it, they'll put a concrete basin underneath and they'll put all of these things that are damaging, guns and knives and things that represent anger and fear and hate. They'll put that underneath, they'll pour it full of concrete, and then she sits on top of it.
Kuan Yin.
Yes, thank you. To suppress those things so that the goodness can flourish in the world. Mm-hmm. Those are nice thoughts, I like those. We have 90 seconds for questions. Any questions about this project, this process? I mean, I'll be around.
How do you select the people you interview?
Yeah, good question. How do I select the people? And it's an organic process. It's different for everybody. You know, people are recommended to me. Sometimes I recognize demographic holes in the project, and I have to intentionally go out and try to fill them. I got 12 stories into it and didn't have any Muslim voices, and I knew that would be an important thing given the politics of the day. So I connected with a group called the Islamic Resource Group and said, hey, here's what I'm doing. Can you suggest anyone to talk to? So I met Zafar Siddiqui, who introduced me to Imani Jafar, who introduced me to Ode, and now I've got this whole web of people that I can talk to. When I'm on, and I'll talk more about this on Thursday, when I do the national version, that's a little more challenging, right? Because I'm coming through an area for a couple of days, I want to make sure I'm productive, so I will find an advocate in a community. When I was going to Portland, I connected with the Oregon Humanities Council. When I was going to Seattle, I connected with the Charter for Compassion. And I said, here's what I'm doing, here's the kind of demographics I need to round out the project, who can you recommend? And they'll come up with, you know, a half dozen or a dozen options. And then I close my eyes and scratch my head and I go, yeah, that's a voice we haven't heard yet. Mm. So that's kind of the process. Every once in a while, when I'm in a bind, I'll throw out a thing on Facebook and I'll say, does anybody know anybody I can talk to? And I'll talk more about that on Thursday too.
How's your soul?
How's my soul? More fed than my belly.
Where's your book for sale?
So they have a few of them over there. We can also sell these. So these were new when you got them in your hands, but now they're used. So normally they would go for $25, but if you want one, they're $20. And then we're going to donate part of that back to Holden too.
And then there's also more in the bookstore.
And there's also more in the bookstore. Yeah. How is my soul? Did you ask that?
I did.
Yeah. This has been a journey of faith and a journey of discovery, and I chose and married well someone who will support me on these things that I like to do, that I think are important. And I have often said to Karen that there's a really fine line between visionary and foolish. And when you're on the path, you don't know which side of that line you're going to land on. And I'm not willing to claim the visionary, but I feel like the needle's moving away from foolish a little bit. So that's good. Oh, I got the snappy thing. Thanks. I'll be around. I like to talk about this project, so feel free to ask more questions and come back on Thursday at 3.
Thank you.
Thank you.